Hi, this is David Clone, CEO and founder of the Holonai Network and director of their Behavioral Sciences Unit, and you're listening to the Holonai Network's Mindhunter podcast on Radio Haver.
Haver. It's not easy butchering people. It's hard work. You know, there's a lot more like me.
We're talking to serial killers.
Serial killers!
New terminology.
Are criminals born, or are they formed?
How do we get ahead of crazy if we don't know how crazy thinks?
It's easier to ask for forgiveness than for permission.
Welcome to the Holonai Mindhunter Podcast.
Okay, I'll call to order the this meeting of the Holonai Network's Behavioral Sciences Division, led by yours truly, Dave the Clone, director of the team here. Joining me for this meeting are Mr. T.W. Brown, one of the voices of Tangent City and a longtime member of the investigative team. How are you tonight, sir?
Doing well. Watching my bees beard up on their box outside, so...
That sounds pretty dirty for anybody who wasn't part of the anyone who wasn't in the green room before we went live. That's all supposed to be as cryptically, disgustingly dirty as it sounds. But sounds like it's just hot fun in the summertime out there by you, sir. So enjoy that while we talk about serial killers tonight. Wow. And also back with us for the debrief here, Jenny Earp. How are you?
Doing fantastic. Staying out of the smoke, hopefully, as much as possible here in Southern Oregon. Yay.
Is that somehow a 10 Minutes in Purgatory reference, just to name drop some of the shows that you can hear Jenny Earp on?
I wish it was. I wish it was.
We're a self-referential network here. You know, we always like to name drop our other shows within our other shows. So if you're somebody, I actually wonder if somebody would write in and tell us what it's like if you just watch one of our shows and just hear about all these other shows. What is your impression? And if you are someone who follows all the other shows and hears about all the other shows, you're like, you're the one who collects all the comics in the big crossover that's going on constantly. So you have the full picture. Mm-hmm. The Night Stalker series, where it was like Ghost Rider, Blade, and like five other comics where they were all those cool black covers. Anyone who was a comic book fan in the 90s, hopefully Marvel remembers what I was talking about right there. But that's not what we're here to talk about tonight. We're here to talk about episode 10 at the end of the journey here for at least season one of the Netflix original show Mindhunter. Easily what has become, I guess, kind of my favorite episode, but I guess just because it's the culmination, so much comes to bear in this episode. It's like we see our guys in rare form when they hit the ground running in Atlanta. It's just so much of it's so cool. I don't want to get too far down the road before I let you guys give us your first impressions before we go diving any deeper.
I have to say that this, to me, watching Ford's character, you can really see him portraying John Douglas to a T based on what I got from the books of his that I've gone through so far. You see the fact that, yes, he is ahead of his time, but you do see his arrogance. And you also see the fact that it's just a simple matter of he's the guy wearing the tie that is the only thing really keeping him from being on the other side of the table. You know, I mean, all it would have taken was one really bad day where he slips and flips and he's the serial killer instead of the profiler. The fact that he can get so deep into these people's minds and that he knows how they work, I think really comes across well in this episode, and it's portrayed well. But to me, his ego and his arrogance really comes through here. And not, some people might see those as bad words, but for what he was doing and what he needed to do and how he needed to be able to stand up for this and fight for something he really, truly believed was going to be a game changer, you have to have it. You have to have that kind of confidence and to an extent, ego and arrogance to really be able to withstand the slings and arrows that are going to come his direction pretty much through most of his early career.
Yeah, it's a tough one to follow right there. Jenny, you have any immediate reactions to this episode? I know we were all sort of looking forward to doing this one.
Yeah, I mean, it's weird because not having not being here for the last one, I was came into this episode and it's been so long since I watched this, but I remember, like, immediately remembered it, and I was like, oh yes, yes, this is one where they have to go down to Atlanta and they set the dude up, and I was like, it very much felt like a Criminal Minds episode. Like, they'd gotten to that point where they're like, oh yeah, we know what we're doing now. But then there's that point where you're like, well, but they're kind of still learning, because it kind of seems like they need to take a little bit more time and just settle themselves down before they start going in and going at people. Because like immediately when they go to Atlanta, the guy, the detective that they're working with, he's like, what the frick are you guys doing? Like, this is super not right. Like, we should not be doing this at all. So it's just a matter of like training the people that they're working with also, be like, we know what we're doing, but it doesn't seem like we do.
Well, it's like, to me, there's a huge carry through. Like, we have a couple things going on in this episode, especially the fact that this is one of the two all season that doesn't start with some BTK killer stuff going on as the cold open.
Very true.
Which, yep. I remember last episode we were trying to figure out how many episodes don't start with BTK, and it's only two, and this is one of them. And it's kind of, I think, maybe significant because it starts with mail being delivered to their office at the beginning of the day. And is it, we're seeing the card that comes from Ed Kemper, I guess, being delivered to Ford's desk.
Yeah, but because the last episode ends with mail, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. And so there's also that, and the fact that last episode, when they first meet the detective from Atlanta and they all go out for drinks and dinner after they've been sort of walking through the crime scene and the investigation, and we saw sort of Holden go into like Jedi mode, I guess, if we want to call it, where he's like literally describing the mindset, and this is sort of now the continuation of that, where it's like we have an opportunity, not only an opportunity to face off directly with him, but they have to now, because against their advice, the detectives in Atlanta went ahead and brought Devier in for a polygraph, which he passed. Which Holden said he would, and they had to immediately scramble to go into, all right, well, now what do we do with this? You know, now that they've done that, which we were really hoping they wouldn't, how do we still figure out how to catch him? Because now it's like a step away from him getting away for good.
Well, yeah, because back then they were like, oh yeah, the polygraph, that's like the end all be all. This means something, you know? And now we know, no, you can fake it, or inconclusive results. Like, they got inconclusive results on that, so it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah. So, unless you're on Maury.
Yeah. It's yeah. This is a point that he hammers home over and over, Douglas does in his books, about how a lot of these unsubs, by the time they sit down, Their arrogance is really what gets them through this, you know, because they're so convinced that they've done nothing wrong that they're not going to technically fail these things, and which is why he was so dead set against putting some of these people down, because at that time, like you were saying, Jennifer, they were, the system was so caught up in the voodoo of a polygraph and believing in its, you know, accuracy 100%, basically, that this was going to exonerate this guy and get him off the hook, you know, which is why he was trying to keep, especially people that are in the mindset that he is working with in behavioral sciences, he was trying to keep them away from polygraphs because he had no confidence in the system's ability to catch them.
Yeah.
And so once, you know, what I think is hilarious is that that eventually, though, is what wound up to them tripping this guy up and to hanging himself. You know, I mean, it's sort of like, well, you know, we know he's a narcissist. You know, how do we play to that to make it work for us? But it's really, you know, the other sort of craft and magic to it is the way Holden, as soon as they arrive at the airport in Atlanta is like, okay, here's how this is going to go down. I want you to pick him up tonight. Can you do it like at 6 or 7 o'clock, like after hours? And from that moment, the detective's like, wait a minute, what? Like after hours?
Yeah.
You know, and half of that is, that's not how we usually do things. And the other half is, shit, I had plans tonight. You know what I mean? There's a certain level of like, what the hell? And it's like, yeah, well, listen, dude, you got to lose those fucking plans because you're the one, you're the reason we had to come back here. So the taxpayers paid for our flight because you did exactly what we told you not to do. And now we only have one more shot to keep this guy from walking.
And they really use the, they really use music to,
I was just going to say that.
Well, scene, you know, I mean, he's like walking through and he's like, you want, I want you to do this and this and this. And hearing the breakdown of it, when he, you know, tells him he wants the files on that desk to look like a phone book, you know, I want to look like the Manhattan phone book. I mean, he is stacking the deck and putting this whole visual show on for this guy.
Yeah.
And then the big reveal is going to be the rock under the coat. Now, when he went down there, that was his game plan. He knew that if this guy would fixate on the rock, he could get him. That was his whole game plan going in. All this other stuff was preliminary leading up to it.
But this was like Kaiser Soze reveal level of layering.
It totally is. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's the that's sort of the brilliance behind him. I mean, behind what these guys did so early on, because this wasn't being done. And to do what he did, I mean, he sent the one guy to go get the baton, you know, rub it in some dirt, do all the other stuff. But during this whole scene, when he's getting down to the criminal's level, watching the faces of the cop behind the glass and the cop in the room is almost the best part of the scene. It's absolutely priceless. Yeah.
You know? During the interrogation or while he's setting everything up and making
during
all
the interrogation? During the interrogation.
Yeah.
Because now you've got somebody present when he's using basically a new version of the quote, ape right cunts line that he uses in Chicago. And this is, he's getting down to this guy's level, but he's also trying to get him to identify. And what he went in as part of his game plan was to basically turn the table around for this guy and get the guy to admit to it by sympathizing that you didn't mean to do this. She came on to you. And that's what happens afterwards. The part that we don't get to see is after they leave the room, when the guy drops his head and he's like, I just need you to say it. He basically just gets the guy to say it by convincing him, man, we get it. This is her fault, not yours. And that's more playing to that narcissistic side. And eventually, yes, the guy does fry. There was a, he has a post rap in the book and this guy did get the chair.
Wow.
So, yeah, but, I mean.
But you saw that even Holden realized he had to adjust his approach by one, stopping the tape at the right time. So there is none of this bullshit with the other tape, you know, to deal with again. Because you're really great English, Dave. Because it's it's really the key to unlocking these guys is to kind of make them think that you're sympathetic to the way they feel more than they think, because they don't think the way the rest of us do. You know, that the sociopathicness of this makes sure that they don't think and operate on the way that people who don't murder people think and operate. And so the only way to get them to even consider the idea of admitting something they did to this level of being of horror is to make them believe that you're just like them, but you happen to be on the side that has the badge, you know. And Holden's the perfect person for that. And I even like that he had to pull the, I'll take full responsibility for whatever happens, you know, and he, even after warning them, said, listen, dude, I'm going to have to say some things that you're probably going to be squeamish about. Just chill and relax and let me do my thing. And then turning the tape off was like the icing on the cake of, okay, you know, that stuff I mentioned outside and you noticed I didn't turn on the tape back on. This is it now. Okay. Are you ready? Like nut up, let's go. And they don't, you know, that actually bothered me when he did the, let's take a break. Like you could be breaking the momentum. What if you throw the whole thing off right now? Like you local guys, you call for help and then you don't let us help. What are you doing?
And that's just it. They have to be invited in. And so they've been invited, but they can get that rug pulled out from them anytime they want. One of the beauties about this interrogation and listening to, because they share a lot of the transcripts in the book, he kind of goes through the whole Q&A portion. Wow. And one of the beauties of what I got to listen to is the fact that he is so sympathetic. He's like, you know, you really thought she was into you, didn't you? I mean, that's just it. You weren't trying to hurt her. You thought she was really into you. And then when it didn't go right, you didn't know what to do. You got scared. You never set out to kill the girl. That wasn't part of your plan, was it? The guy's like, no. God. That's it. Wow. It's over. Wow. Got it. Yeah. That's how he hooks him, by basically sympathizing with him and saying, you didn't mean to. And that's how he reels him in. That is the, like I said, I wish they would have put that scene about another 60 seconds and let that play out. Because when I listened to it, to me, that was one of the most impressive moments of listening to how he operated. And you kind of miss it. You get all that great buildup. But to me, it was like getting all the buildup. And then now they're laying in bed smoking a cigarette.
I don't know. I liked it. I thought him shaking the way he, you know, like, and he was shaking more and more the closer that they got to concluding the whole thing. And
you could really hear his breath too.
And the total tone shift as well. You know, before he turns the tape recorder back on, they're all still doing this sort of like, hey man, we're all sick perverts as well. It's all good. Admit shit. It's fine. We're here for you, bro. But then when they uncover the rock and see his face, and then they start the tape recorder again. At that point, he and Tench are just like two sharks both pulling the same piece of dead floating whale in their own directions. Because fire it's like
just from one side to the next. Yeah.
It's like, so you know when you do that, blood sprays everywhere, right? It's like, yeah, man, it gets all over the place. It's like it probably gets in your ears and your nose and your hair and your fingernails. It's like, should we check under his fingernails? He's like, no, he's probably washed his hands since then. He goes, but what about his hair? Yeah, there's lots and lots of capillaries in the scalp. That blood is just like a fine mist. Yeah, it's probably in your ears. How often do you clean your ears? And you see him like looking at them going like, wait a minute, what clean my ears? Like who cleans their ears? You know, like little things like that on his face that show you like, wow, you know, he walked into this in the beginning of the day thinking, well, like I cleared the polygraph, I'm gonna help them, they actually want my help, like I'm not a cop, I'm not an investigator, you know, but they want my help in solving this case, all right, maybe I can help them out. It's funny how that sort of I got away with it ego makes you suddenly think you could pull off pretending to be a super guy, you know, not even just a good guy.
It's also that ego that he doesn't even realize any of the button pushing on the recorder. Like, how do you not understand? It's a recorder. Everybody knows how to use one back then. It's two buttons for a record. Like,
yeah, you don't just understand. He just pushed pause, man. Like yeah, right in front of you, he pushed pause and nothing else.
Nothing. That's what killed me. I was like, Devier was so inside himself and just like, yeah, I got this. I don't even have to worry about anything. Like, he wasn't paying attention to anything around him until the rock. Yeah. It was crazy. That whole scene was so good.
The sickness of the idea that there's a place where 14 is the age of consent, and for a guy like this to even, I mean, like, come on, even if it is the age of consent, the fact that you're doing it is still disgusting, man. Like, don't hide behind the technicality. You know, that's still gross.
Yeah. Welcome to Georgia and a few other choice places in the South.
Wild. But it was neat to watch them, you know, use their Jedi mind tricks.
Oh, exactly.
And have it completely work. And then I really liked the scene afterward, because this is the most human we've seen Holden in the entire season, I think. You know, like this is him in bed afterwards with a cigarette. You know what I mean? This is his like
grocery store sequence.
No, at the bar when he's flapping his gums.
Each other on the back, good old boying each other. Yeah.
Well, also, like, the way he feeds off the sort of way that they look at him in awe. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I was going to say, that to me, his attitude in the bar in that scene feels like, oh, yeah, now I feel important now, so I'm going to just keep going. You know, like, oh, you guys like what I do now, so I'm just going to boost myself up some more and because I'm a badass now. It felt a little bit fake for me for him in that second.
That's you see that serial killer parallel.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Ego and that serial killer parallel that he's got, you know, I mean, he admits to, you know.
Yep.
Wow. You know what? I didn't even think about it like that until you just said that. And this is, I don't know, the 10th time I've watched this episode, you know, Wow. Yeah. I mean, Holden again, and I've at this point, all right, it's the last episode of the season. You won't have to hear me be a broken record about it anymore. But the fact that he's not going to turn out to be one of these serial killers really friggin' still eats at my brain. You know, like this could have easily become a historical fiction show where it has certain elements where they change what happened in reality. And the idea of a character that starts out this level of Clarice Starling and then becomes Hannibal, that would be an interesting show, I think, you know, and this definitely has the tone where that would be believable. But, you know, here I was thinking maybe this is Holden at his most human, but that is an interesting way to see it. This is Holden in his celebration phase after getting away with his, you know, 15th murder and burying the head under his worst enemy's house or something.
you see, and I don't know if I was tainted by listening, because one of the things that happened when I got to listen to a lot of his books is I got a little tired of the I did this thing that he does in his books.
Oh, he's interesting.
He's really into telling you what he did. he's really into it. It doesn't matter and I reference the BTK thing, but he almost takes sole credit, despite the fact that he'd been retired and out of the force for over a decade when Landwehr and company nailed this guy. And they had already come up with an idea of how they were going to corral him. And it just happened to be very similar to what they get told when they go up to the behavioral sciences place and talk to these guys and talk to, you know, the namesake here. And he almost takes sole credit for the capture of BTK in a couple of his spots in his books. And it's like, wow, he is really full of himself at times. You know, it really got difficult to listen to. And that was that seeing that scene in the bar, I'm like, that's the guy that wrote that book.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And also him in the grocery store afterwards as well, you know. Which I don't know what to make of the way it was staged, how like he's just tossing things into the basket, you know.
Yeah,
like,
who does that?
Like
that bothered me so much.
When is something gonna break?
Yeah, like willy-nilly, I'm like, I guess you don't have any eggs in there, huh? Like, cause you're just, and she's not saying anything about it.
This jar of ragu in there. I mean, everything just got tossed in, and yeah, that was, my wife was watching this with me, and she's like, when is something gonna break?
Yeah, that bothered me a lot. I'm not gonna lie. Okay, so I have a question, because I can't remember if it happened earlier in the season. When he's about to get in the car, he sees the guy walk out of the grocery store. Who is that guy?
That's the principal that wound up getting fired and lost his life, basically. But he can still afford to go buy liquor and eat peanuts as he's walking out of the store looking like a potential serial killer. But I also felt like the layout of the store felt weird to me. You know, why? I've never seen pineapples just on a shelf like that, you know.
Yes.
like the way the produce was.
True.
and how it's like he grabs,
it was hanging, there was like lettuce like hanging too. I was what is happening here?
Strange. Without really making too many turns, they were able to grab frozen pizzas and then a jar of tomato sauce and then like a thing of either cottage cheese or sour cream, or it could have been ricotta sauce, but there's a lot of Italian staples being grabbed. And yes. I'm not really sure what the significance is there, but it's also the fact that it was all just being tossed in together. And then they walk out with just two bags.
Two bags. Thank you. Yeah. I said that this afternoon. I was like, that was a lot of things for two bags.
And they do the whole thing where it was almost like if those were two children, they would both be slamming both of the kids into the seats in the back and then slamming the doors closed. Like, there was so much I fucking hate you body language going on.
They didn't put them on the floor or anything. So the first time they go in a corner, that stuff's all over the back.
Gone. It's all gone.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I noticed that too. I'm like, oh, that's going on the seats. You know, come on, man. There's nothing to weigh that shit down. Was there drinks in there that we didn't see you juggling before you threw them into the basket? We come back from doing all this. And the first thing they get kind of shit for is the fact that, and they never really tell us who did it, but either the detective or the young uniformed police officer basically gave a transcript of the entire bar conversation to the Atlanta Chronicle or whichever newspaper it was. And it paints Holden as this like superhero new cop kind of new way of investigation. So, you know, everybody else is worried about it. And Holden's like, meh, this is kind of cool, actually. You know, that's like me and going,
Dick flag fly in this, too, because when he tells Stitch, are you just jealous because your name isn't mentioned? I was like, what a dick.
Well, and the way he said it, too, like almost like a concerned guidance counselor, teacher, kind of school psychologist, like, what's really going on here? Tell us your feelings. Is it actually...
I'm surprised Bill didn't, like, punch him right there or something.
Is it actually that you're just unhappy that your name's not mentioned, man? Like... I don't know, dude. It's the more and more I watch it, I feel like it's either Holden or his girlfriend have to become serial killers at some point. And just knowing that it can't be Holden, now you got to put money everywhere else. Like maybe Tench will become a serial killer at this point, for all we know. Let's at least veer off.
Done. Yeah, that was, I mean, and that whole scene, you know, the room is dark and they, and he come, and Tench comes in with the papers and he just kind of tosses them, and you really see that there's kind of some, there's some really big cracks here, and there's going to be in any, you know, in any professional relationship, you're going to have your ups and your downs, and they've been in a down cycle for about the last three or four episodes. It sort of started when the big, I'm not going to go see Brutus again.
Oh, I guess you mean the between the relationship between Tench and Holden.
Yes.
Okay. Well, and Wendy is complicating it because she's the one who's the most upset about this newspaper thing. Like, yeah. Tench is pissed, but she's immediately like, oh my God, we got to go there. I got to call the state, the district attorney. Yeah. You know, like, I got to deal with this. And everybody's like, wait a minute, why? And even Tench is like, what are you doing? Like, what? Why are you? No, you're not going to listen. You're not going to change anyone's mind. They're going to kill this guy. That was the whole point of this. Like,
there's her academia side coming through again. And to me, that was and that was his stab at, because he's got a really hardcore belief that comes across in his writings. He's very pro death penalty, and you can tell that might have been a really big stab at the people that are against it, because obviously she sort of symbolizes that whole thing. He talks numerous times at how disappointed he was that Dennis Rader didn't commit a murder after 1994 that they could pin on him to make him eligible for the Kansas death penalty.
Wow.
He is very pro death penalty, and so to me that scene read a whole different way watching it this time now after reading his books, because Carr is sort of the liberal bias sitting in the room, and he is the very hardcore right side conservative. And there was that clash there that really shows. And he's like, if you don't think you're going to get blood on your hands, you're in the wrong building.
Interesting.
Yeah, well, he's been very matter of fact about everything. And I mean, part of that makes it like hard for me. Like, I wouldn't have read this as a hardcore conservative thing. Like, I would have seen his side as more analytical along the same lines as Wendy Carr's. It's just that her sensitivity, I still think, is so that she will look as good as possible when they decide to publish this thing. You know what I mean? Like, she's just like, we can't be associated with getting this guy killed because people will stop talking to us. And it's like, no, some of these guys are already in jail for life. You know what I mean? Like, it's not like that's going to change. This guy they caught, like, this should be, in my mind, they should be happy about all of it. You know what I mean? This proves that their work is valuable and that it's going to lead to being able to catching guys like this.
That one was worthy of a mission accomplished banner that meant something. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then, as if that hiccup isn't bad enough, then they have to go and come back to the time bomb that was waiting for them ever since Greg Smith decided he had to put the tape in the mail. I mean, again, this is to me where, like, look, if you're in a group of people and they make a pact that we have to destroy this tape, it's the only copy of evidence that could incriminate all of us. You don't leave that meeting if one of the people at that meeting is the one who has the tape. You either all go to where the tape is and watch it burn together. You don't then all just go back. All right, I got to go to lunch, so make sure that tape gets burned. All right. Like, make sure the only evidence that could fuck us is destroyed, and not, you're not going to have a sudden change of heart and decide to turn us in.
Yeah, no, that was ridiculous. It should have been something that Holden took care of himself. If that was their decision, he shouldn't have let anybody else deal with it. Honestly. Yeah. Especially since he's all like, I'll take the blame on this one, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, that should have been on his shoulders.
And but you also saw that division in the sand where they don't even glance over at Greg Smith. While they're out in the hallway having that conversation and they're getting reamed by their director, they're both glaring at Carr. Both of them. They're not even glancing at their comrade, who is the guilty party.
Although, no, Holden does look at Greg Smith. When Greg Smith opens the door and sticks his head out, he turns and looks right at him. It was you, fucker. I know that. Like, you know, the thing is, I didn't even realize that so much until I watched it again this time, that there was a legitimate reason for Tench to think it was Carr. You know, that the last time they came back from doing something else, there she was sitting there listening to the tape with the boss. So she's got the history of ratting them out because of the goody two shoesness of her academic side, you know? And so it makes sense for them to think that. And Tench is pissed because it's all like, I feel like we've already dealt with this and now you went and fucked us again. So I'm tired of being nice about the fact that you pissed me off, you know? And I kind of liked that moment with Tench.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I liked her response as well. You know what I mean? But that's also when he looks at her and then Ford looks at her, then he glances over at Smith and he just gets this look and he's like, he has it all figured out. He knows exactly what happened because he just sat there without saying a word. He read the whole scene, which is what he does. And now he knows exactly who did it and who's at fault.
Well, and that kind of goes into the next scene. I think it's right after that when Holden gets home over to, why can't I remember his girlfriend's name?
Debbie.
Right now. Debbie's house.
Actually, we reversed it. That scene came first, but it's fine.
But that whole scene was very like Sherlock Holmes to me because he like picked out like these three details and then he was like, oh, you want to break up with me? After like this whole spiel that he went through, monologue of shit that she was going through, and she just like sat there like, okay, I guess I did want to break up with you. All right, peace out. Bye.
Yeah, and I mean, I love, there was something about how real that whole situation felt, too. Yeah. For as much as I would have never experienced it through a Sherlock Holmesy sort of POV, but the idea that, like, you get home thinking, all right, here's the rest of my night. We're going to go to dinner, and then we'll come back. We'll listen to some music. Maybe we'll have sex. Maybe we won't. We'll fall asleep. Like, you're in the routine of the life that you've gotten used to, and... Yeah. Hold up. You know what I mean? Like, I get here and wait a minute, you're acting a little weird. And it's just the same way that he sets the trap for Devier at the beginning. She sets the trap for him with this conversation, you know? And it's like, okay.
Yep.
You've been bitchy the last time, 10 times we've hung out. We always fight. You knew I was coming over. So you sat out here, but you didn't bring out an extra glass, and half the bottle of wine is gone. You know what I mean? Like, I think there was something else. He's like, you've been critiquing me lately, and always casting me in a negative light. And then he goes, you offered me a sip, which could be construed as welcoming, but you don't have a glass for me, you know? And then it's like, you're taking the edge off to break up with me? Fuck! And it's like, what have we got for him?
Just profile their relationship. Yeah. You know?
He's
never off the clock. And I think that's what it showed, is the guy never comes off the clock. And
She wasn't necessarily kissing his ass so much, though. You know, like, she wasn't giving him the same level of adulation for this big win that the cops in the bar were. You know, that's, I think, the big part of the grocery store scene, was that she was, like, kind of throwing a wrench into him just feeling awesome about himself.
Yeah. You
know, she was on the same side of the situation that Carr was, you know. This could read as coercion. You know, she didn't come out and use those words. Because, you know, that's not her, you know, that's not her forte, the whole legal field. But she was basically parroting in a different way what Carr had just said back at the office. And that's not what he was expecting when he walked in the door.
Yeah.
I just bagged another pervert. You should love me even more today.
Yeah. And he's like, just once, can you just be my girlfriend? Like, for fuck's sake, what is this? You know? And, he also said there was something about how she was always, even though she had already passed her exams or something, she was making sure she was staying up late doing homework so that he would be always going to sleep by himself.
Yeah, like, by himself, yeah.
All these like little subtleties where it's like it's a legit thing. You're saying you have to study. I have to take you at your face value of that you have to study. But you're purposely studying so that we don't fuck. That's not cool. Yeah, I don't like that. And so I love too the parallel of that same, I guess we call it the Debbie's broken up with Holden theme of the show, because it's the same as the day after he caught her in that experiment, getting all close to her lab partner. There's this sort of like minimalist single note kind of theme music going on when he pulls up to work the next day. And it's like,
oh, yeah.
There's something about the realness of that, too, like having to go to work the day after you got broken up with or that you broke up with somebody. And it's like, oh my God, how am I supposed to think of normal shit when all I'm thinking about is how horrible life is right now, you know? And
yeah.
I love that we see that again. But it did sound like that their whole relationship ever since they got back together was just not the way it was originally. It was just not, never got back to the, like, the good that it
had. Too tumultuous. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And of course, not only does he come back to deal with the whole more bullshit about the tape, he also gets a message from a doctor to get in touch with him as soon as possible.
Because, you're so good.
Because he's so good. Somebody's emergency like contact. That he's like, how did this happen? Who are we talking about here? And they're like, yeah, Ed Kemper has you listed as his call in case of emergency person. Apparently Ed Kemper tried to take his own life, so he's got that to deal with as well.
And that really leads to it's such a good finale setup for them, because this whole thing for him starts with Kemper.
Yeah.
And now he's riding high and really, you know, he's been cocky and arrogant and everything else like that. And now he has to sit down face to face with somebody who, for all he is, you know, the serial killer that he is not a stupid man, you know?
Yeah.
And he basically picks Holden apart, you know? I mean, because Holden's now got to, you know, he finds out that Kemper tried to kill himself. He's going to go out to this hospital and meet in this room with him. And, of course, this is not prison where the security is top-notch and there's a guard standing there. Anyway, this is a hospital where, while he may be shackled, he's got a little bit of mobility, and Kemper sort of turns the analysis table around.
Well, there's a lot going on in that whole sequence, because, you know, as soon as Holden shows up, Kemper's like, I didn't even expect this to work. So it's like, already you're like, wow, wow, you're Joker level crazy, man. You will kill, will almost kill yourself. Just to force my hand. Like, he, you know, there was like, in his mind, it seemed like he had a 50-50. I know we haven't handled the dealing with the sort of trouble of the tape situation yet. But since we're here, we might as well stay here. But, you know, it was like, what if he didn't survive this suicide? Well, I guess it doesn't really matter, right? Like, for Kemper, he's in prison for life. It's not like there's a lot to lose at this stage of the game. And that's what makes him probably super dangerous as well, you know?
He stays upright in prison, and that's it.
But I mean, like, so he straight up says, you know, I've made several overtures and invitations to you, and I shouldn't have been surprised that it took something dramatic to actually get you to show up here. Yeah, you know,
that's just
like,
super creepy. It's just super creepy. The whole thing is just super creepy with those two. Like, they feed off each other. It's like this parasitic relationship between the two of them.
Yeah. And I think they trade who the shark and who the remora is from time to time.
Yeah, it's so true. It's so true.
And it's easier to be friends with a serial killer when they're still shackled to a table, you know what I mean? Or when there's still security guards, armed security guards, like, watching to make sure they don't kill you. You know what I mean? So there's that, which I think, you know, what we can glean from this, or even basically what Kemper kind of comes out and says, is that he's sort of, I don't know if I would say annoyed, jealous. He's not happy about the fact that, because he got to read this article as well. This is another side effect. They not only had to not only did Carr try to convince the district attorney in Atlanta to not go for the death penalty, and she basically got laughed out of the Capitol for that. Kemper got to read the article and go, oh, so Holden, who says we're friends, is using our conversation to get famous. Like the anger is more about that, like about Holden taking credit for all these things that Kemper basically told him, like that, you know, it's like, it's not like Holden would have been able to figure these out without him. And we get the feeling that Kemper is feeling a little left out in the credit department.
Well, and that is something that you gather from these serial killer profiles, is the level of narcissism. You know, I mean, it's that level of narcissism that ends up getting BTK caught, but it's the fact that, so now the papers are going to talk about you and not me, and now I'm a subtext in this thing.
And
so for him, that's gotta be a, that's a, that's a slap to the face, you know, that's a brutal slap to the face for somebody with that kind of mind.
And I almost wonder if he knew in this hospital that if he would had tried to kill himself, he would wind up in intensive care, where there would be this blind spot in the security. Like he's either been there before, or he's sent people there, or people he, who have been there, he's talked to, and he's, they're like, oh yeah, man, I swear to God, if they, you know, if they came during shift change and that guy was in the visitor's chair, I'd be able to snap his neck before anybody would even realize anything happened. You know, he intimated, he's like, I can not only kill you, but do a couple things to you before they would even know that you were dead. You know what I mean? It's like, well, who the hell? He goes, it's an oversight. You know what I mean? And it's like, yeah, I'll be sure to tell them about that shit if I live through this. Like, trust me, this oversight's about to get corrected.
And guys inside, that's one thing that is common knowledge and shared around, is, you know, the any weakness in the system, whether you plan to exploit it or not, when you find out about it, it gets shared. Everybody finds out about it. That's part of being inside. I mean, that's part of the communication code. So, you know, if that ICU unit has a weakness, believe that's common knowledge in the joint. They all know about it.
Which is funny, too, because when, you know, and even when this happened, you know, like the first, the way it's shot, this whole sequence, you know, when Kemper sits up and puts his feet on the floor and there's this sort of like a thunder thud. It's like a park rumble. I'm like, where's the cup of water with the ripple in it?
The T-Rex is moving.
And I didn't,
so fast too.
Like it would seem like a superhero, you know what I mean? Like the Flash. But I didn't notice the first time around. I mean, I think the first time you watch this scene, it's uncomfortable, it's scary, it's very intense. But I didn't notice the first time around how many times his eyes keep darting over to the security station. You know, this time I picked it up because I was watching. And I mean, he definitely had this planned. And I don't think even he knew, though, whether or not he was really going to kill Holden. You know what I mean? Like, it seemed like there was a part where it was 100% 50-50, you know, like this easily could have. And the first time watching it, when I didn't realize or know that this was based on a book and that Holden isn't going to eventually become a serial killer and that he's actually a living person who wrote the book, so obviously he survives this moment, I was like, oh God, man, did you really just walk into this after this whole season? After all this, after tripping other people up, you, like, the only thing you didn't do is wear a tie, because he would have been able to use that to choke you out. You know what I mean? Like, oh my God.
They're not done. There's more to come, but you'll have to come back for part two.
You've been listening to the Hollow Nine Network, bringing you the very best in fan-made media. That's the word hollow, the number 9, INE. Now broadcasting from our new home on the web, hollow9.com, where you can find info on all of our awesome programming as well as the team behind the shows. Leave us your feedback, join in the conversation, and be a part of the action. Find the Hollow Nine Network on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Snapchat. Rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcasts. Email us at info@hollow9.com or at hollow9podcast@gmail.com. Join in the fun. Hollow Nine.